Tonight our speaker is Pat V. We can give him a warm welcome. He's all the way from Santa Maria, California.
As you can tell, I'm milking it for every moment I can get. I've never spoken anything longer than, or as long as 40 minutes, but we'll keep it from the hip and real. My name is Pat. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Pat.
We'll start off with me. That was always the self-centered person, but my full name's Pat and my middle name's Jesse. I'm named after Sergeant Patterson, which is one of my dad's army buddies, who was a drinking buddy of his. And of course, my mother didn't like that, so she never called me Pat. And my middle name is Jesse, because I'm named after my uncle Jesse, and that was another one of my dad's drinking buddies, and she didn't like him either. I'm telling you. So I was called PJ for the longest time. I grew up as a child PJ. It was easier. I never did like Pat anyway. And when I wanted to become serious, I used the name Jesse. I took karate from Mr. Lee down here at by Wimpy's Liquor, and I wanted to be taken seriously. So instead of PJ, I used the name Jesse. Let's see. Here we go. It's not Patrick. It's after Sergeant Patterson. Mom and Dad, they both met in Japan. Back in 1958, and my mother was a surgical nurse. She, if you ever watch MASH, they say just stitch them up and send them to Tokyo. Mm-hmm. Well, she was in Japan, Camp Zama, and what they did there is she was an OR nurse, and they did plastic reconstructive surgeries, eyes, nose, ears, metal plates. They took ligaments, skin grafts, rebuilt eye sockets, rebuilt jaws, anything from the neck up. And my dad was, at the time, he was an honor guard. And he had two tours of Korea and one tour of Japan. And Japan is where he met my mom. And they were married in Japan. Then they were married on the ship. And then they were married once again in the United States. So they got three marriages up for the price of one. I remember all this stuff because it was always told to me. It's almost like handing down a story. You know, you pass it down from generation to generation. It's just almost like things that are important are always passed down. The important things are what we remember. And we want to explain that to other people, just like the steps and just like a lot of the things that are in this big book. The big book. I like that. I always watch the speakers, and they've got places and notes, and their books are always well-read, and mine is rather new because I'm new at this, so you're going to have to bear with me, but I always like the fact they had that book right there, because that's what I've been going from since the day I first came in to these rooms. It's the story I wanted to hand down. Let's see, they are married in Japan. They came across on the USS Garvey, because at the time they didn't have airplanes. We had ships. They came through the Panama Canal. And let's see, I was born at Fort Lewis, Washington, which is a great place. I made sure that I was stationed there when I joined later on. My other sister, Victoria, was born at Fort Ord, California. And the last of the family members, Aurora, was born at Fort Greeley, Alaska. Aurora is the one who I'm thankful to, because she joined the membership and fellowship of AA, 20 years ago plus. She's always tried to drag me into these rooms, but I was never, ever ready. Even in 2006, when my mom passed away, we used to live right over here at Stoll and Western. And when she passed away in 2006, I just wasn't ready for the fellowship. I wasn't, it's because of God. It was a God thing. So I wasn't ready for that, and my sister Aurora, was born in Fort Greeley, Alaska. That's the coal weapons test center for the Army, because when my dad came home from his second tour of Korea, he said he never wanted his men to be cold again. And I'm a history buff, so I learn and read about stuff. Anything that is history related, I love. And that's where she was born, Alaska. I happened to be there for the big quake in 65, I believe it was. And that was something I remember because it was scary as a child. Not as scary as seeing herds of caribou, herds of every imaginable animal you could imagine, just thousands and hundreds of them. It just, the beauty of Alaska is something that it's hard to explain to people, but it's such a natural, peaceful beauty that I reference because God, my higher power, has shown me throughout my life, whether I was willing to learn, listen, see, the beauty of his creations. And I reference that because God doesn't make mistakes. Every one of us has got our cross to bear. I just thank God I'm very blessed to have been born healthy. I've got my quirks, I've got attention deficit, I've got a few other medical problems, but God doesn't make mistakes. And I have to remember that I've been fortunate enough to be so many different places at so many different times that I'm available now to really grasp that. I mean, my sobriety wasn't just handed to me. I had to really earn it. It's just something that I wasn't ready for. I took my first drink at St. Joseph's before a dance at St. Joseph's out behind the school. There was a bunch of sand dunes there, and now there's a bunch of houses. I was amazed how much that's built up, but it was all sand. And the liquid courage, just to get us a little bit of breathing room to deal with the opposite sex and dancing and things that I thought were such a hard thing to do, that now I find out it's easier to do when you're sober because you can remember them. That's one of the things that in my drunk log, a lot of it I can't remember. I probably don't want to remember because when you have people tell you what you've done when you've blacked out, it's not pretty. It's scary because you think of yourself as never one to do such things. But when alcohol takes a hold of you, it takes you places you never thought it would take you. It hurts in the memory of it, and that's why some of it, for me, I have to learn to start talking in the first person myself. I didn't want to remember some of the things because I never thought I was capable of the lying, the cheating, the stealing. I've heard all the little coined phrases like, I would steal something from you and then help you look for it. These are all the similarities with these rooms that I love because I really don't have to. You can basically finish my sentence for me because we all know what it's like to have terrible things happen. And we're not, I could never take responsibility for the things I did. It was always somebody else's fault. If I was upset with somebody, it was because they did this, they did that. It was just things that happened to me in my life that I either glazed over or just ignored them. And now that I've got sobriety, and the pink cloud's gone, and just the memory of it, just I have to go through because on my steps I've had to do a fearless and searching moral inventory. And like they say, more will be revealed to you. And I'm receptive to be revealed more because my higher power is a God of my understanding. I went to St. Mary's School because in February 11, 1968, let me backtrack. My mom and my dad, they married. We went through the Panama Canal. I was born at Fort Lewis, Washington, and we proceeded to travel across the United States from Fort Lewis to Fort Ord, from Fort Ord on Route 66 to Fort Dix, New Jersey. Mount Holly's where we lived. And every 6 months about, we traveled between Fort Dix and Fort Ord, and then back up to Fort Lewis. I can remember 9 different times traveling on Route 66, back in the old days when there were just all the little traits of the little dinosaur on the side of the road. And I remember it was a Plymouth Valiant with a column shift, and we drove the wheels off that car. I remember Fort Lewis, Washington being up there because the apples. And I remember when we went through Kansas and the plains because of the corn. And everywhere we went, we had different, I remember New Jersey area because they had that shaved steak with the onions and the, came in a big hoagie roll. And I'm a kid, I'm less than, God, between 5 and 7. We traveled, like I said, I counted 9 different times. And first it was just me and my sister Victoria. And then pretty soon after we went to Alaska, Fort Greeley, like I said, Coal Weapons Test Center up there. As I said, my dad didn't want his men to be cold. The main thing was where I grew up in an Army family where there is no gray area. There's only black and white. I had that drilled into me because my dad later became, like I said, a drill sergeant. And I remember him coming home after a few drinks and trying to teach me the manual of arms with a .22 rifle, single bolt action. Yeah, it was Remington with a kind of like a plastic fiberglass stock. It was taller than I was, probably weighed more than I did. And I remember trying to do the manual arms and being yelled at. I remember coloring outside the lines on coloring books at school and then parent-teacher conferences and the fear of when he got home, if he had been drinking, being spanked with a belt. And they had thin belts in the back of the old days. They were dress belts, thin ones. And those things are brutal on the skin. I've got scars on the back of my back because you try to spank me on my butt because that's where you usually spank a child. But we got invented, me and my sisters, we wear thermals underneath our pajamas to cushion it a little bit. And then he got smart and made us pull our pants down, so that didn't help us out at all. But discipline was a very, very real factor in my family. Being Hispanic, you're raised not with so much of a heavy hand, but they don't pull their punches when it comes to raising their children. They expect them to be obedient. And I didn't know at the time that culling outside the crayon lines was not obedient. So I had a harsh upbringing. And my sisters did too. I took a lot of the heat because I was the oldest. But some of the problems that we endured as children, both my sisters and I, anything from verbal abuse to physical abuse to sexual abuse, it was always that I would try to take the brunt so my sisters wouldn't have to. And because of that, my one remaining sister, Aurora, she joined the Fellowship of AA at an early age because she understood more than I did or was willing to the fact that her problems, her deep down problems that caused her to drink were because of the upbringing and the abuse. I still was at that age, being the oldest, to like glaze it over. I've gone back since my clarity and of moments of clarity and remembered that when he went to Vietnam, I wished with all my superhuman powers in my head that I would make his head implode. I wanted him to die because of the abuse, not only for me but for my sisters. And that was all based upon alcohol. I remember as a child, he would come home from his drill sergeant duties, as in barracks and stuff like that with his men. And I got to go with him to the barracks and saw firsthand of how he trained his men. Because when you're training your men for a battle and war, you have to train them because if you don't train them properly, they're going to die. And that's not an excuse for what he did with his drinking, but after 2 tours of service for him, I can only imagine the horrors he saw in Korea. Like I said, it's not an excuse, but I've forgiven my father. I've also forgiven my mother because after he died February 11th in Vietnam, we moved to Santa Maria here, and he always said that this would be the one place you get to stay. The phone number will never change. Your address will never change. You'll have roots. You'll get to grow up here. And it was true. I grew up here. Like I said, I went to St. Mary's. I became an altar boy. My mom worked in the convent. She cooked and cleaned for the nuns there. I took guitar from Sister Dorothy. It was a beautiful life. I then went on to St. Joe's, and that's where I had my first drink, and everything was great. And after St. Joe's, they asked me to leave at the end of my junior year because, I was acting up. And well, I remember a lot of times I acted up. It was because of my psychological problems and having to deal with the abuse. And that's probably one of the reasons why alcoholism is just a symptom of something deeper. And I can never forget that, because every time I want to help somebody, I want them to understand that there are symptoms that once you stop drinking, you have to really look at them, because you can't just stop the drinking, because if you stop the drinking, it'll be gambling. And for me, if you stop the gambling, it'll be fast cars, fast women, relationship problems. It'll just be overeating, undereating, different types of drugs, different kinds of escape. Escape as in running away from your bills, escape from going out and shopping. I call that retail therapy, but I just don't remember having to pay so many bills, because I've always been taken care of most of my life by the women that took care of me. Last one being a marriage of 35 years in Manchester, New Hampshire. I'm going to go back and forth because I have attention deficit and I'm doing 10 things at once, but there's so much information I want to give to you all, but it's just so you can understand a little bit about me, because I'm just a little bit like you. I too have been hurt as a child like you, and I'm sure a lot of you have understood the difficulties of not so much stopping drinking, but to keep stopped, and then to grow from there. And I know for a fact that the big book here and these steps, and like I said, I didn't have a working relationship even after St. Mary's with my higher power, because I wanted God to smite my father, you know what I mean? I wanted his head to implode for the abuse, and I didn't really like God, even though I was going to St. Mary's and St. Joe's, because God killed my pet dog Fluffy. God killed, you know, everything that happened. It was bad. I blamed upon God because I didn't know who else to blame. Even as an adult growing up, I never took responsibility for the things I did. You know, I glazed them over and always blamed somebody else. And God was the, you know, God. I just was so tired of it that I just refused to have a working relationship with my higher power like I do now. Because my higher power is a loving, kind, thoughtful God that I now listen to. Every time I come to a meeting, I have a little bit of God inside me, a little bit of daily reflections. That's a God smack is my favorite word, because every time I'm having difficulty, I pray. I pray in the morning when I wake up. I'm grateful that I'm breathing. I'm grateful that now that I want to live, I'm alive. I want to live. I don't want to die. Life is beautiful, and the main thing is that, oh gosh, I'm scattered all over the place. Main point that I was trying to say was I love life, and that the daily reflections give me a God smack, or when I hear someone share, it's the similarities of, and I wasn't ready to come into these rooms because, like I said, my God was at the time earlier too vengeful, too mean, too... I blamed him for everything. Yeah. I blamed him for when my sister drank herself to death in February 2006. See, all three of my family members that have died, my dad, my mom, and my sister Victoria, that she's the next one. I'm the oldest, Victoria's the middle, and Aurora's the youngest. February 11, 1968, my dad was killed in Vietnam. We moved to Santa Maria. February 6, 2006, my sister died because she wouldn't stop drinking. She ended up looking greener than the Jolly Green Giant at University of Medical Center in Las Vegas. Even when she had a blood transfusion, her boyfriend would come in with vodka, unbeknownst to me, and she continued to drink. She just wasn't ready to stop. She just couldn't stop or didn't have the tools or the pain with me. I think maybe the pain was too great for her. She was more sensitive than I was. But she took all the pain to heart because it hurt her that badly, her failed relationships. The love of her children was something she wanted to keep and loved the children that she, because she was trying to make the family better than what the family was that we had as a father, my mother and father. That's why I've never had children, because I didn't want to raise children in the cycle of abuse, the cycle of sexual abuse, physical, verbal. I always said that I'd rather adopt children because there's so many out there that really need a home. And I didn't want to bring children into the world myself. It's just something that I kind of like use that as punishment for myself for having such a bad relationship with my father and my mother. Even after my dad died, my mother tried to raise us, but having a series of boyfriends she had, I had issues with not so much what they call uncle. This is your uncle so-and-so, and he's just visiting for a few days kind of deal. But it's just that I would wake up and hear my mom, I would think in pain, and go out into the living room, and, you know, they had the muumuus where they can zip it up really quick and fast, and they were on the love, the name of that chair escapes me. That's Lazy Boy. There you go. But I just remember as a kid growing up saying that if that's love, I never wanted ever to be in love. Because it just hurt, you know. I didn't know the sounds, what they meant, and the whole thing about growing up and reproduction and all that stuff. I was foreign to me as a child. And because of that, I still have issues with abandonment. Because of that, I still have issues with dealing with women. And that's something I can look at now wholeheartedly because the alcohol isn't numbing me out so badly. The drugs. See, I start drinking and everything is off the table. I thought marijuana was just a easy something to take with it, but that leads to something else. For me, the gateway drug was alcohol. That is the addiction that caused my downfall last year, and that's what brought me to these rooms. I've never had so much pain and sorrow in my life, thinking that 40 years ago, my first drink out at St. Joseph's would cause me to come back from Germany out of the army, pretty much a failure. New Hampshire, I spent 30-some years there with a beautiful, well-loving wife. I had the perfect house, I had the car, the high-top conversion van, 6 dogs. I had a nice pond overlooking with my little boat. I'd go out there with my 6-pack and Golden Pond type deal, and I thought I was going to retire out there. And one day she came home and said, "I don't love you, and I want a divorce." And looking back on it, I blamed her. I was angry with her. I just couldn't believe that, you know, someone would want to leave me. I thought I was all that in a bag of chips. But looking back on it with clarity, I guess the 2 half-gallons of vodka a week kind of like spoiled that perfect image. And that's one of the things I really like about these steps, is that you can put into focus with the help of my sponsor, of course, the clarity of what the responsibility is on your part and what you can expect from other people and how to deal with time, space, people, places, things. I guess now, looking back, my parents were closet AA members because all of the signs that used to be up here, one day at a time, being, I think that's the new one, but I mean halt and all the old, I thought it was being an Okie because they have all these cliche terms and stuff, but you know, where the rubber meets the road, and, you know, I know a lot of it was Route 66, because there was a lot of flat tires, and, you know, we got into an accident one time out of Oklahoma, and a lot of good food, but then a lot of bad food, and I was always wondering why a dad around evening time would stop in a certain type of a club and leave the kids in the car, and he'd go in, and then mom would go in after him after being upset, and she'd say, stay in the car, and I never really understood why. And I remember one time, there was this one club where they had this, like, a tower, and there was a lady swinging on a trapeze. And I thought that was the neatest club in the world, you know? Like, here the kids get to watch this lady on a trapeze. I now know that was a big bar and stuff. And I remember my sister had to go to the bathroom, so my mom went into the bathroom with my sister. And then my dad, my mom sent me in because my dad had gone in, and he wasn't coming out, and we had to get going. And Route 66 is only so far, but with all these little pit stops along the way, it's like the bathroom stop. You know, can we go to the bathroom? No, you went to the bathroom before. You have to wait. And, you know, I remember holding it in. Like, it was like, and all you see down the flat plains across the United States is these rows of corn. And I always knew that if you look sideways as you're traveling down, you can see the road. And it's flat. It is so flat. The road is just, you could see for miles, and you just wish it would end. I do, because as I had more siblings come into the car, first it was me in the car, and then my sister Victoria, and that was okay. Then we had my younger sister Aurora. I got relegated to the floorboards. The two sisters were on the seats. But when you're traveling X number of miles per day, that muffler gets awfully hot. Awfully hot. I remember laying back and just waking up, and my back was on fire. And that muffler was glowing. I remember that. And then, plus that and being spanked, you know, that kind of helped with the healing process. I guess the heat kind of like sears the skin so it doesn't bleed anymore, I guess. Because I've got deep scars, not only emotional, but physically. Because I tried to do everything as a kid that was suggested. But that's another trigger, suggested. That's what the book is in here, is a lot of things are suggested. But I'm getting used to suggestions, because without these suggestions, I would have never made it through, as someone once put it, the uncover, discover, and discard. Because all these little quaint sayings that were up on the wall, they really helped me in a time of my need. And I remember some of them even as growing up, you know, like my mom had a good one, just give it a lick and a promise. Yeah. But like I said, just like the lady in the trapeze, that has a double entendre saying or meaning, give it a lick and a promise. I'll let you guys figure that one out. But growing up as a kid, I remember my dad having poker games over, and I remember one time the poker game table was knocked over, and there was a fight. Somebody was cheating. Of course, it was not so much the cheating, but the alcohol. I remember a lot of times, like I said, we had an accident coming back on Route 66. It was because of the alcohol. Like I said, having my mom send me into the bar to get my dad to come out, that was because of alcohol. I just recently found out that my dad, who had already served 2 tours in Korea, didn't have to go to Vietnam, but he told me that he volunteered to go because he'd said he couldn't send his men to Vietnam because there was a different kind of war, and he didn't know what kind of war it was, so he had to go. And I thought that was quite honorable for the longest time. And then as I'm discovering more things about it, I remember being with him when he was a drill sergeant, and I used to go to the barracks with him, and I remember finding out that we went to a bar after the barracks, and he hit a car, and because he didn't leave a note on it, or he probably left a piece of paper going, sorry, and then took off, but because of that, he was going to lose his drill sergeant's insignia, so he volunteered to go to Vietnam. Just a lot of things that were all blamed upon everybody else, but the real culprit in all was the alcohol, the common denominator, the similarity of alcohol. I just thought alcohol was the greatest thing at Vine St. Joe's. It gave me courage. It gave me, I thought at the time, strength and energy. But what it was doing, it was sapping my strength, sapping my mental. I mean, I started using four-letter words faster than anybody else as a kid. because I lowered my standards even at that young age. I was not to be eloquent and use, you know, your God-given talents is one thing, but then to suddenly lower yourself down to such a depth where I wanted to jump off Stoll and 101 and become a spot on 101. I had a box of raisins, and when I was done, because I was homeless, I lost everything, my marriage, you know, the realization of losing this, looking back upon my abuse, looking back and realizing all of everything that had happened to me up to that culmination of last year. I told myself, you know, you have to eat, but you don't have anything to eat because you're homeless, and you don't have a job because you don't have an address they can send you a letter, and you don't have a phone they can call you for the job because you're homeless, and you don't have any money to pay for the phone. And it was like a catch-22, a never-ending cycle. I spend more energy trying to get the alcohol and the drugs than I did try to anything else. I mean, I lamented having the fact that I didn't have a job, but the only thing I cared about was getting that next drink. You know, the cycle was vicious. And I remember sitting on the overpass stool, and it was horrible. I had a box of raisins, and I told myself that when I finished that last raisin, I was going to climb that chain link retaining wall fence and jump off and become a spot on 101. And that's the lowest point in my life. I mean, I dealt with the abuse. That was a low point. I dealt with wanting my dad dead because of the abuse and then him dying in Vietnam. I blamed myself for that because I thought my supernatural powers had made his head implode out there. Because I still hated him. I hated my God at the time. I hated about everything. I know I'm growing up and I hated the way I looked. I hated the way I walked, talked. Everything was just so uncomfortable. So unhappy. And that was just something I just pounded the alcohol down. I remember just not drinking like anybody else because, like they say, someone could open a bottle of wine and they just pour a little bit into a glass. And I was like, how could they just sip that and then set it down? It was like, I go in there, order a double or a triple and have two of them ready one after I finish the other. And I'd be angry with the bartender if they didn't have another drink right after I finished the drink. I just didn't drink like other people's. I guzzled. I bought boxes of wine because the glass gallons were too heavy to carry. I mean, you know, you could fit more boxes into it. Just all the craziness of what I went through to get that alcohol. You know, waiting till the stores opened or making sure you had some put away. All the cliches were always like that. I don't think I ever put a bottle into the toilet tank. I don't think I went that far. Well, I guess that's not too far, but I mean, I did start to hide alcohol in the garage. All the things, I would have thought I would have quit after my second DWI in New Hampshire. I would have thought I would have quit after going to the second DWI. You had to go to jail for 3 days and then go through an 11-day program to get your license back. And then after that, you get called what's aftercare, where you have to go to AA meetings. But I wouldn't go to AA meetings because that was a god I didn't want to go to. That was someplace I didn't want to go. But yet alcohol had taken me to a place I never wanted to go. Alcohol had taken me to a place where on the East Coast it was crack houses. On the West Coast here it's meth houses. And the girls are still the same, or the guys are still the same. They would sell their soul or their child or their car, their phone, their clothes for that alcohol, for the drug. It just, for me, once that drink hit, I would find myself in places I never wished to ever be, but I was there. I'm not proud of it, but, you know, it's part of my story because without that having happened to me, I would have never been ready to accept a God of my understanding. I would have never been able to accept these steps. I would have never been ready to walk into these rooms. After that day where I wanted to kill myself off 101, I tried to check in the shelter, and they said they didn't have room for me. That's because I was still drinking and using. I have to take responsibility for that because that's me. I could have taking care of the fact if I would just stop drinking, but I couldn't. I was at the point where I didn't want to, and I couldn't because, I don't know, you're at that point for 40 years drinking, you don't really think about why you can't quit. It's more like you don't want to quit. You know, you still romance the idea that it's still fun to drink even after you puked all over yourself. I mean, I remember pulling my t-shirt up and just puking because I didn't want to get it on the carpet. You know what I mean? I remember walking to the bathroom and just, you know, changing the shirt carefully so you didn't get it all over you, but then going right back and making myself another drink. I didn't stop drinking after pancreatitis. I started turning greener than the Jolly Green Giant in New Hampshire. I remember them hooking me up to the opiate, where you just push a button and it gives you pain medication, because pancreatitis is one of the most painful things I've found that you can have happen to you. I didn't stop drinking after I went to the bathroom one time, number two, and all I had was a fountain of blood coming out of my rear end. That was diverticulitis. You could have a polyp inside your intestine, or you could have a bubble on the outside. And I blamed everything on why I had too much fiber, or you know, the pancreatitis was caused by stress, or the DWIs were caused by stress, or they were caused by the cop would just follow me after I had been drinking and saw me walk out of the bar. But I never took responsibility for what really happened, which was me having a romance with alcohol. And everything they say is true. It started out as a great romance. I loved the sweet taste. I loved the feeling it did. I loved the numbing. But then when I started drinking just to pass out, I should have known then it was a problem. I should have known when my wife left me after 34 years. I didn't want to stop drinking to save the marriage. I wanted to lose the marriage so I could stop drinking. And that's the insanity of it all, thinking that I can control it. When I finally realized that I could not stop drinking, and that didn't happen until I was ready to jump off the overpass. I tried every way. Once I came from the East Coast on April Fool's Day, I landed at LAX. April Fool's Day, huh? Godsmack. I wasn't ready to quit drinking until I wanted to get into detox. I actually stopped drinking for, at that time, the longest time I'd ever stopped, 2 days. And I was 2 days clean when I got into detox. And I was one of those 90-day wonders because I'm a veteran, a disabled Army veteran as well. And I got into detox for 90 days. And that's why I have this beautiful thing called 6 months of sobriety. And things have been looking up for me ever since then, because I know now that my higher power has been talking to me the whole time. I just wasn't willing to listen. I thought I could romance the alcohol again. And I was the kind of guy, like in Alaska, when they say, you know, don't lick the swing chain because it's like 20 below and your tongue's going to stick to it. You know, I saw the other kids lick it and I thought, oh, that's, you know, fun. I remember peeling off a bit of my tongue on that chain. I remember also them telling you don't touch the oven or the wood stove, it's hot. I remember the other kids touching it. I remember watching them and the bubbles and the blisters. And I remember that I never wanted that to happen, so I didn't touch the stove. I remember them saying that alcohol is bad for you. But I watch the other kids puke. I watch the other kids wreck their brand new car when they went to St. Joseph's and got it for a graduating present, or like I think it was sophomore years, they got the Z28s and all these new cars that came out. All they did was wrap it around the tree because they were drinking. I remember all that. I just didn't learn from that. I tried to learn my way. I got out here, like I said, tried to stop drinking alcohol by just like every imaginable way. I actually started drinking the expensive stuff thinking that would do it. The only thing that happened was I drained my bank account. I had enough money to stay in hotel rooms because I was homeless out here looking for a job, looking for a place to live. And I drained $5,000 really, really fast in the span of less than a month. Not so much on the hotel rooms, which is great, because you can always find cheap rooms for $50 a night, and they have weekly and monthly rates now, but it was the alcohol. I wanted to try drinking the expensive stuff. I spent $250 on a bottle of Cabo made by Sammy Hager and his conglomerate group. Custom handcrafted wood box, hand-blown glass bottle, and it tasted like the best tequila I've ever had in my life. But I thought I'd just have, they even gave me two free shot glasses. I thought that was awfully nice of them. I spent $250 for a bottle of tequila and they didn't give me free shot glasses. I was impressed because I thought I had it in my pocket. I know how to do this. I can quit drinking if I just drink a little bit of the expensive stuff. The only thing I forgot is that when the bottle gets empty, I want more. Even if it's closed, you're too late. Out in New Hampshire, 12:30, you can't buy alcohol anymore. Out in New Hampshire, you can drive around in your vehicle with an open container. I thought that was the greatest thing because I had this little ice box you open up and it sits in the center console. It's got two drink holders and I just would sit around and drive with my... I did everything with a beer in my hand. I'd fall down and never spill a drop. I mean, we do some really... I do some crazy things. Never spill a drop of alcohol. Barbecue with one hand and still balance things while trying to eat. And like I said, I have attention deficit. I'm doing multitasking, three things at once. But I think I'm doing it great. But I'm not. I think by the 10th drink, they won't notice me. I'm not. And I would be walking sideways. I'd be puking around the corner. You know, come in, swill another drink, swishing around in my mouth and go, "Hey, beautiful, how you doing?" And that was the smell of puke and the smell of vomit and the moco is coming out of my nose thinking I'm just all that in a bag of chips. But it wasn't. It was a hot mess. A hot mess. The drugs didn't help out here either. Like I said, one drink led me all the way down that path to where I was still homeless. But I was hanging out with other homeless people who knew where to get the free food from, who knew where to go for the free clothing. So life was easier for me. We had parks, Seamus Park out here. To go out there, and that was my summer home. You know, I joke with everybody, that's a summer house, you know what I mean? Who else has this beautiful... And I romanced it to death. I romanced it to death. Why? Because I didn't want to stop drinking. Why? Because I didn't want to realize what it was doing to me. You know, I had a heart attack in New Hampshire, unknown origin. I think it was just because I'd been drinking too much and started doing drugs out there as well. And they said I had an unknown date and time of that one. And then because of my high blood pressure and other problems, I had three heart stents put in. The first one I had was in Boston, and they numb you up a little for the heart stent. They go in through your crotch area, one of your main arteries, I guess, or whatever it is, and they come up with a wire into your heart, and they're saying, "Oh no, there's no nerve endings." I said, "No, I could tell you where the heart," and they got me strapped down, but I could tell them exactly where that wire was because I felt it in there. And they're showing me on the fluoroscope or whatever, because they put the dye, you can see like, wow, this is blocked off. And then they went in, and I'm thinking, oh, this is just great. They're going to, you know, put a stent in and a balloon. And well, they knocked off one of the blockages. And I heard them saying, "Oh, this guy's coding." And there's three of us. There's me, another guy, and another guy. I think one of those two guys on either side of me is like, he's coding. They're poor son of a bitch, and he's going to have a heart attack. I ain't going to know what code blue means, you know. But it was me. They knocked the blockage out, went around the system, and came in. And all of a sudden, I remember I couldn't breathe. And it's funny, because I'm staring death in the face, and I'm thinking, like, I can't wait for another drink. I want to get this procedure over with. I want to go out and have a drink. You know, and I woke up in the emergency room there, and I mean in the intensive care, and they gave me fentanyl. And that was just another drug. That warm blanket that came over me reminded me of being in the womb. That warm blanket reminded me of my mom's hug. That warm blanket coming over me, that was almost like the first time I had alcohol, and it warmed me from inside. That was what I was always seeking, that warmth, that love. What am I doing on time? Gosh, I'm doing great on time. Now that I want to live, I can't thank these rooms and these people in here like yourselves and everyone else because they help me live life on life's terms. I want to live. And by giving it away, I get to keep what I've got. There's only one thing I can say to all of you is don't ever stop helping that one person who doesn't want help. Because it could be me. Are we doing our time? I'm done? Okay. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Pat. Let's give Pat another good hand for doing such a good job. Okay. Now turning me back to our secretary, Don.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Trey. Thank you.